Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
It's The Wonky Show. Professors back on grade inflation, but will consistency kill autonomy? A curriculum shakeup in schools is coming. We'll work out the implications, and Wales raises fees, but chokes back maintenance. It's all coming up.
Universities are adopting, you know, different marking processes. You know, one is using the full range of marks, and the second is adopting categorical marking, you know, where a grading system assigns a percentage score to a classification band, ensuring consistency. So this is not grade inflation. This is actually helping and supporting our students in their study.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and here to chew the fat over this week's news. As usual, we have three brilliant guests. In Harrow, it's Alex Stanley, Vice President for Higher Education at the National Union of Students. Alex, your highlight of the week, please.
Thanks very much for having me. Yesterday, we had the all-party parliamentary group for students, where we brought students from across the country together to discuss the post-16 education and skills white paper.
And in Upfield, it's Michelle Morgan, Dean of Students at the University of East London. Michelle, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, I have to say, it was Lewis Bonfire Society parade last night.
Lovely. And somewhere in the southwest, no one's quite sure where, it's DK, David Kernahan, Walkie's Deputy Editor. DK, your highlight of the week, please.
I'm going to say Zoran Mamdani winning the New York mayoral election. I've got a couple of mates in New York, and just to see them just feeling hopeful again is a lovely, lovely thing.
So, yes, we start this week with grade inflation. OFS has published new data and a big new report. DK, walk us through it, please.
So the OFS is getting stuck into degree algorithms, is the long and the short of it. It feels like there's some practices in the sector that it feels, I'll quote, that it is difficult to show that awards accurately reflect the achievement demonstrated by students at the point of assessment, and that these have a potentially inflationary effect. Hang on to that word potentially, because this gets wild. So the two things regulators particularly concerned about is the idea that a university will use multiple degree algorithms. So in a lot of exam boards and program boards, if you sit on them, you might be used to the idea you've got like an algorithm that takes into account all of the marks for the last 2 years of study, but includes a weighting to slant it towards the third year. And you might have another algorithm that actually discounts the two worst module marks. And then the student gets the best result of the two algorithms. That's quite a common practice. According to OFS, that is a bad thing. It particularly doesn't like the idea of discounting credit with the lowest marks, so just getting rid of those lower two modules. So the big news, it is not clear to us, says OFS, how a provider can demonstrate that it's compliant with condition before using these steps. So if you are continuing to use these steps, or if you are planning to change to an algorithm that uses these steps after September of next year, you are told to let OFS know this by the 31st of July 2026. There might be some further guidance coming on that. Alongside this release of the report into degree algorithms, we also get three reports on investigations into grade inflations. Now, these are ones that were opened back in September 2022. There's a couple of them, St. Mary's University Twickenham and the University of West London, that deal with the practices during the pandemic restrictions. There's one of them, Teesside University, that looks more generally. It's important to be clear that none of these universities are currently in breach of condition B4. St. Mary's and the University of West London might have been in the past, but have since made changes. Teesside University has never come close to breaching condition before, but the Office for Students, in its infinite wisdom, has decided that it's an increased risk of doing so anyway. And that's the thing, apparently. It's not taken any further action because they reckon both have taken appropriate steps. And I should just also mention the wider grade inflation issue, the ostensible reason for all of this stuff. This is a third successive year of a decrease in the percentage of students receiving a first or a 2-1. That's now at 77.2%. And it is getting harder to get a good degree in England. And that apparently is what our regulator wants.
You know, activities and processes at universities are changing, like, you know, getting rid of 24-hour late submissions with a 5% penalty and introducing extensions like Tony spoke about on Wonky, basically is going to raise the marks. And if you compare it to a previous year, which was, you know, have the 24-hour late, you're going to see potentially what is grade inflation. And what the report doesn't necessarily clarify is their acknowledgement of those marking processes that's... You know, maths and hard sciences, for example, it's easier to get higher marks, whereas humanities and arts. So universities are introducing, you know, categorical marking and adopting the whole use of marks, you know, so they will have an impact.
I mean, Alex, Michelle makes a good point because just to some extent, it begs the question, is grade inflation necessarily a bad thing?
I mean, not necessarily, no, because I think there is a nuance and there's a balance to it, because of course I'm sure there are cases where grade inflation is just that, but equally it can be a response to high quality teaching. It can be a response to the fact that over the last decade as a sector, I think we've got much better at mapping the provision at institutions to the actual needs of students. And as we see our sector diversify with regard to the students studying in higher education, I think that's something that's really, really important to consider. And I mean, if you look at a lot of the universities mentioned here, we're talking about post-92 institutions, the ones who predominantly use that more flexible model, a model, by the way, that has been well established over a decade. And these are institutions that typically have a large number of students from low socioeconomic backgrounds whose families wouldn't have been to university, who are likely to have caring responsibilities or work part-time, or are just generally having quite a tough time alongside their studies. And institutions know this, institutions recognize this and are responding to this. That's why we see these nuances in systems. And we don't want to end up in a situation where one bad mark is dragging down a student's entire average, making it difficult for them to move forwards into the job market. And I think the OFS needs to be really careful in understanding the different needs of students and the fact that universities often do know best in responding to them.
Alex, I absolutely agree with you. And I think, you know, although we've just briefly been looking at this, what I'm not seeing in the report is, frankly, any acknowledgement that universities have been changing their process to be more inclusive, equitable, compassionate, and basically have a duty of care. I mean, at UEL, this is something, you know, our vice chancellor has pushed for a long time in developing policies and processes. And let me give you a couple of examples that are not unique to my university, but are most certainly important to consider in this context. And if these changes are not taken into consideration, you can see how there's going to be accusations of grade inflation. So for example, one, we removed the 24-hour late submission option that has a 5% penalty and introduced 2 7-day extensions per term without penalty for eligible pieces of coursework. And this is to provide, as Alex has already highlighted, you know, support to our diverse student body, providing breathing space to cope with the complexity of their lives and any clashing deadlines across a semester, which in effect is, you know, 12 weeks of teaching. But straight away, you're going to see an improvement in the marks. And I know that Tony Moss from LSBU has written for Wonky on explaining how this has been transformational at his university. And the other thing is, disciplines like maths and hard sciences often involve more quantitative assessments with single correct answers. So basically, they generally get higher marks, whereas in contrast, humanities and art subjects are more qualitative. And this relies on interpretation and professional judgment, which can be open to multiple valid interpretations and a wider range of marks. And so universities are adopting, you know, different marking processes. You know, one is using the full range of marks, and the second is adopting categorical marking, you know, where a grading system assigns a percentage score to a classification band, ensuring consistency. So this is not grade inflation. This is actually helping and supporting our students in their study.
DK, I want to talk about external examiners, because this is an issue that came up in the white paper as well, and it's now back in this report. The RFS says that external examiners don't provide adequate assurance about degree algorithms because they focus on module level assessment, not overall classifications. But are we basically witnessing the slow death of external examiners in front of us? This is coming from more angles now.
Well, there's been a number of quite senior policymakers who have had a bee in their bonnet about external examiners quite a long time. Firstly, we should say that practice is different in different institutions. There are some institutions in which external examiners also look at a course level and they do get involved in conversations about courses overall. This particularly happens in courses that are linked to a professional, statutory, or regulatory body that have got external standards, and external examiners do a big job in assessing them. The second is the focus on degree algorithms is perhaps a couple of steps removed from any possible idea of grade inflation, in the idea of it is your individual module marks that matter. If you're not getting good marks in your module, to a certain extent, doesn't really matter what the algorithm is. You're still not going to get a particularly good degree if you're not doing it right. And external examiners are the ones that have an eye over the content of those modules, the way that content is assessed in a way that reflects the student's proposed learning outcomes. And they are also on the module boards. The exam boards deal with the marks across the piece. So it does feel like people are unhappy with external examiners at the moment. But this should really be a matter for individual institutions. Every institution has got to make sure that their courses, that their modules are of a comparable standard to everybody else that's teaching the same course. If they're not doing that, they're going to get found out quickly. They're going to get into problems with employers, with PSRBs, and it's going to be bad for them. So every institution is doing this via talking to external examiners and PSRBs. It's difficult to see what another system that could also do that job would look like unless you're going down the road of a national curriculum for higher education. And I do not think that we're doing that.
Something weird about this kind of piece of regulatory action. I'm struggling to get my head around. We just got these reports in, you know, right before we started recording, so we're still digesting it. But RFS has found that there are, you know, several universities that are in breach, that they're not taking enforcement action. But at the same time, they also acknowledge that they've never published these views about degree about algorithms before. So somehow universities are in breach and they fixed the problem before the investigations even began, and it was and it's based on something that they weren't ever told they needed to do. So it's sort of, I don't know, something doesn't quite add up here about what's going on. Can you help me understand?
Well, I'm glad they've offered us so much clarity on all of this. It really is a tough one to get our minds and our heads around, isn't it? I mean, I just think that the regulator has missed the mark on understanding universities responding to the needs of their students, responding to the different experiences of their students, and I'm struggling to see what the point of this is, or whether they've just not got the context of what institutions are trying to do. I mean, without repeating what's already been said, I think it's something to celebrate that universities have been so agile in responding to the fact that the student body is diversifying, and that means that people have different ways of learning, people have different lives alongside their studies, and where algorithms are responsive to that. Okay, just because they might not perfectly align with the OFS's potentially more traditional idea of what assessment should look like, I don't think that's something that they should be bashing institutions on the head for at all. I mean, I can give examples of institutions where you've actually seen slight underperformance because of a focus on more local graduates. But that's not, we don't see people banging the drum there as an issue of grade suppression in any sense, do we? And so I think it's really important that the IFS do try and listen to the sector here, do try and understand why it is that we see these different algorithms, and understand that in many cases, this is actually a good thing.
Just been having a little look at the report on the University of Teesside. Now, this is a report that not only did not find a current breach of condition B4, it also did not find a historic breach of condition B4. And despite this, we appear to be in a condition that the OFS has found Teesside University is at an increased risk of breaching that condition of registration. And I'm looking through the charts and the data towards the back, and I'm just at a loss. So the Office of Students have run what kind of basically amounts to a little mini version of Robot Wars. They've competed all of the different algorithms against each other on a single year of results. And you're saying, okay, if the algorithms are absolutely equivalent, there'll be no change. If they're pretty close, you will not see a significant difference. If they're way off and there is a difference in the use of algorithms in this way, you will see a wild difference. There is no significant difference between these algorithms in the way that they have been implemented at the University of Teesside. You look at how they did things in 2013, they made a change in 2014, and they made a little tweak in 2019. There's not a significant difference. It's just not. I mean, this is not a question of interpretation. This is not, well, I see it this way and you see it that way. This is actual stats. So why they've decided that the University of Teesside is at an increased risk of breaching condition B4, despite having presented absolutely no evidence that they have come anywhere close to breaching condition B4 in this particular way, I am at a loss. I do not understand. It's like they were looking for evidence of grade inflation. They were looking for a smoking gun. They didn't find anything that was like the popular folk devil of grade inflation, which is let's give students a load more marks so they'll say nice things about us on the NSS, which was the Michelle Donnelly model of change. They've not found any evidence of that. So they've just decided, okay, we don't like some of these algorithms. We don't like, I mean, the stuff that we've talked about, which is there for a very good reason, the discounting of a worst module or the idea of an escape velocity or the idea of using multiple algorithms because different students have faced different issues over different times. And even with all that, we're still not seeing any evidence of any actual grade inflation impact from the algorithm. And yet still, they're apparently at risk. I've read lots of things from the Office to Students. I've read all kind of stuff that has just made me sit back and gasp. But this is just, I just don't get it. I am at a loss.
Right, so let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm V. This week on Wonky, I've been blogging with Dr. Brendan Coulson about the Lifelong Learning Entitlement, or LLE. One of the major changes being introduced by the LLE is the ability for individuals to use student finance to fund short courses and modules. Unsurprisingly, much of the national conversation has been focused on that flexibility. In our piece, we argue that while modularity has the potential to reshape how we deliver.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
Deliver courses, demand is still untested, making it a risky investment for both the individual and the higher education provider. We highlight other reforms in the policies that could be just as transformational: the expansion of the priority additional entitlement and the removal of the equivalent lower qualification rule. To conclude, we have also shared some recommendations to help the sector think beyond modularity and to plan more strategically for the LLE.
Now, next up, a long-awaited curriculum and assessment review in England has landed with potentially big implications for HE. Alex, tell us more.
Well, absolutely. It's been a big week in schools policy here in England with the arrival of this report from Becky Francis. The government has endorsed the majority of the recommendations and will now move ahead with some pretty significant changes to the national curriculum. It's worth noting that the review has also informed the white paper that I referenced earlier, and the press release contextualises these changes as key to delivering Prime Minister's target of 2/3 of young people in higher education learning by the time they are 25.
The EBAC combinations of GCSEs come under fire for making the curriculum too narrow. It's going to be scrapped as an accountability measure for schools. The review also stresses the importance of HE institutions both recognising and understanding the importance of T levels, but also the new V levels. And finally, it states that exams should remain the primary form of assessment, albeit noting that the number of them should decrease due to concerns surrounding generative AI and authenticity.
Lovely. Right, lots here. Michelle, let's start with those V levels. What do you think it's going to take for admissions teams in the sector to actually trust them? And yeah, how are we going to make that work from the HE end?
I think it's going to be very, very challenging. I sort of feel like we've gone back 3 years when we were talking about discussing BTECs and getting rid of them and the T levels were introduced. And I'm not seeing how the introduction of the V levels is actually going to work. And I'm struggling to see how we're going to get traction and uptake in comparison to the other longstanding qualifications. T levels are just not an extensive qualification used to enter higher education. And I can very much see the value of V levels, but I'm not sure how we're going to be able to achieve that.
DK, what has gone wrong with the EBAC?
So the EBAC is like an artificial selection of courses that the government, supported by experts in their field, believe are pretty near essential for every school child to take a qualification in. This obviously is English and maths and the sciences. There's also other stuff in there. And it has become like the default, like everybody will take these qualifications. The problem with that is the UK in general and England and Wales in particular have got a problem with early specialization. If you don't choose to do your three separate sciences at GCSE, and there is a recommendation in the Becky Francis report and in the government's response that all children should have the chance at least to do a separate GCSE in each of the main physical sciences, physical, chemistry, biology, and physics. If you don't do them, that makes it hard to get onto A-level STEM subjects. If you don't do A-level STEM subjects, that makes it hard to get onto STEM courses in university. And then, I mean, what do you know? We have a shortage of scientists in the UK. So the problem that the EBACs have faced is they narrow everything so much and they take up such a big part of the GCSE curriculum that it's quite difficult to allow children to specialize early on. It's been a big problem with the provision of stuff like arts and music and anything creative, an industry in which the UK is a world leader. It's really hard to specialize early on unless you're at quite a posh school. So the announcement that they're going to scrap the idea of the EBAC, it's a dated definition issue, but it is going to be an important one because it's going to open up a lot more of the wider curriculum and a bigger range of qualifications for young people to study.
And, I mean, Alex, there's a revised national curriculum which is due to be published in 27, first teaching in 28. I'm really interested in kind of what the opportunities that brings for HE and FE to some extent, and how sectors can work together and kind of shape what they're thinking about now in terms of assessment and programs to respond to this.
I mean, one of the first things I read this morning was the Daily Mail's headline of Labour dumbs down schools. And I'm really pleased to see that the media are engaging in such a thoughtful and nuanced way. That's a view that I very strongly disagree with. I take this and I see a real opportunity, as you say, not just for schools, not just for students, but also for us to sort of map skills from an HE perspective. I think particularly when we're having conversations as a sector about things like specialization and being agile as a sector and responding to the needs and wants of young people and of learners, this is a really big opportunity, because I think what we've got coming up next is a really important consultation process moving on from the review. We also, as NUS, our president Amira chaired the Shadow Curriculum Assessment Review. So we've had plenty of opportunity to feed in, and we're going to be encouraging our members to feed in as much as possible in consultation processes moving forward.
But on the back of what Alex has said, Jim summed it up really nicely yesterday on Wonkey in his piece, What the School's Policy Got to Do with Higher Education? Because at the moment, there feels a disconnect between what the review is suggesting and any discussion about how higher education should respond. And if there is to be a push on T and V level qualifications, then as a sector, universities need to actively engage in the process to look quickly and effectively in terms of their curriculum and assessment so that there is effective bridging, connection and onboarding.
We've touched on V-levels and the importance of getting it right. I think the point that's really important to make here is that these will be nothing without the confidence, one, of learners, but two, of institutions. There needs to be a real endorsement there. And I think the best way to go about achieving that is to see the perspectives of teachers and of trade unions weaved into this, because the review talks about introducing a lot of new things, not just V-levels. And I think for a lot of teachers, a lot of staff, there is a bit of fatigue there. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be pushing forward with reform and with new opportunities, but it does mean that people have to be taken on that journey when it comes to implementation and how we go about things.
So a thing that stood out to me is a number of times that the document uses the word applied, and there does seem to be a big macro trend in education more generally at the moment that everything needs to be applied, everything needs to be linked to the workplace, everything needs to be linked to the job. And I mean, that's great as it goes. It is really good in teaching to connect the problems that students are dealing with to a real world issue. But I think the overemphasis on applied runs the risk of failing to prepare people for higher education. I mean, obviously, large bits of HE are applied in the strictest sense, but you also need to have some academic skills around research, around writing an essay. And if you don't have enough of that in your GCSEs, in your A-levels, you're going to really struggle when you get to university. And that's going to be an issue, especially in year one, especially with academic support. It would be nice at some point in some kind of government document to see some recognition of the value of academic skills, which can also be vocational, which can also be very useful in the workplace, but are outside of this applied lens.
What I thought was very clear in the report was the recognition regarding the need for digital proficiency and the inequitable experience of students across primary and secondary education across these sectors. And Professor Rose Luckin, who's an AI education expert, commented yesterday that it was good that there was recognition that 80% of schools aren't teaching statutory computing properly, but there also has to be an acknowledgement that digital literacy must be taught systematically, because basically it isn't. And I think what's critical for me is that it's important to recognise that you can have digital literacy, which includes the ability to use and understand digital technologies, but it's not the same as having digital learning and experience. And I know through my work from the pre-arrival academic questionnaire, which explores learning materials that undergraduate students have used in their prior studies, that the main methods in accessing learning materials are still handwritten notes and a course textbook. And use of digital and online materials are quite low, as is the use of libraries in accessing information. And yet, universities post COVID-19, we still make the assumptions that students are experienced in digital literacy and digital learning. And I think that is something that we really, really need to work on and actually work with secondary and primary schools to ensure.
Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Sure that there is a linked-up approach to it.
And finally this week, the Welsh Government is planning to lift the undergraduate tuition fee cap to match what's going on in England. Michelle, talk us through what's going on here, please.
So it's been announced that the Welsh Government will lay regulations to increase the undergraduate full-time tuition fee in Wales for 2026-27 to match England, although the exact level is still not confirmed until the budget, because the Welsh Minister, Vicky Howell, says she will confirm the exact amount of the increased tuition fee cap once there is clarity on the position in England. Following the white paper, the minister has noted that fees in England will rise for at least the next 2 years. Howell says that she is of the view that the same increases are appropriate for Wales. However, in Wales, there are elections next May in which Labour is expected to lose, so we'll only get concrete plans for 26-27. Student support, including the value of grants, will rise by 2% based on the consumer's price indexed inflation forecast. But it's important to note that tuition fees are based on a higher retail price index forecast. For the second year running, Wales will move away from linking its student support package to the living wage, probably due to pressures caused by the need for fuzzily defined parity between its system and England's.
Okay, Alex, this is fascinating, isn't it, coming right ahead of elections in Wales?
Well, absolutely. That context is really important, because what we saw in England is a much more long-term plan, whether that's with regard to fees or regard to maintenance, whereas what we probably should be doing in Wales is keeping our eyes on what both Plaid and Reform are saying. I think with Reform, it's slightly harder to guess which policy they're going to pick out of a hat on any given day. But with Plaid, we've seen some indication from previous sort of policy positions that they do want to get to a position of free education eventually, but do that by over time gradually decreasing the fee, I think beginning with taking it back to £7,500. And one of the ways that they've spoken about funding that, interestingly, is by removing the £1,000 grant for Welsh students studying in the UK but outside of Wales. So we're already starting to see a picture being painted of what funding might look like under Plaid administration in Wales. So in the short term, frustrating for students starting now, seeing that burden of debt increasing. As research by the Sutton Trust shows, students from poorer backgrounds are more likely to be debt averse, and what we don't want is any student or prospective student to be put off from studying at university. But absolutely, this feels like something that at least for now feels like a short-term measure with big change coming around the corner.
I think one of the things that has come out of this though for me is that there is a difference in repayment thresholds between Wales and England. Their threshold here is going to be 28,500, but in England it's 25,000. And the repayment period is also different. It is 40 years in England and 30 years in Wales. So we have significant differences.
Yeah. And DK, presumably this is going to affect, possibly tip the balance on cross-border student flows.
I think that is some of the thinking. I mean, if you look at the four nations of the UK, the only really significant cross-border applicant flows are between England and Wales in both directions, because of the close geographic proximity of Wales to numerous large English providers, including many in the Russell Group. The temptation has always been for Welsh students, particularly high achieving Welsh students, to look to England to continue their studies. Now, the Plaid position is very much that Welsh students should really be looking to study in Wales in the first instance. And if they start to bring in some of the measures that they're talking about, you will get probably a reduction, although it is difficult, as always, to say exactly how price sensitive the undergraduate student market is, given that we have had lots of experimentation about price differentiation and support differentiation, and it's not made a huge impact in the behavior of applicants. So it remains to be seen how effective this is, but certainly this is an interesting direction of travel. We should be keeping our eyes also on Scotland and Northern Ireland, where policymakers will likely be watching this with interest.
Alex, so the tuition fees are rising with RPIX, student support only is getting CPI, so there's kind of a growing gap, isn't there, on the kind of maintenance side of things?
No, there is. And that's an area of real concern for us. I mean, we know, speaking to students on the ground, that there isn't a student discount on rent, there isn't a student discount on your bills. And so students are feeling the very harsh end of this cost of living crisis. I mean, I speak to student union officers all the time, and people who should be talking, nerding out on topics like quality and being good academic reps are instead talking about implementing things like community fridges and food banks, because those are the immediate needs of their students. So I cannot emphasize enough the importance of there being adequate maintenance support. Of course, you do probably have a slightly better system of maintenance in Wales than we do here in England, but that doesn't mean that we should be shying away from further maintenance increases, because they're absolutely necessary.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Alex, Michelle, DK and Michael Salmon for making it happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week live from the Festival of Higher Education. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.